Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you for this time of gathering. Thank you for everybody that's here, and pray or rejoice in the fact that Christmas is over, and now we're kind of back to our regular routine, so to speak. Thank you for all that have gathered here this morning in order to hear about our mission trip in November. Pray that you bless this time, inspire us, allow us to think about the possibilities of the future, and allow this time to be more conversational than lecture-based or teaching. It's really just telling a story about the fun time that we had in Mexico, getting to know our brothers and sisters in Christ in Monterey. So I pray for your blessing over this hour. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, so I guess as I work through the presentation, here, actually, I'll show the picture this way. If you can see.
It's better than slides.
Yeah, I can't. My eyes are starting to get worse as I get older. They're bad enough, but that was one of the churches that they were building in the Apodaca neighborhood. I have the map of Monterey. You can look at it when you pull it up online. But the thing that I think, and I told Jim to talk over me if he so wishes, because this is supposed to be more conversational or just a report to the congregation about how our mission trip went. But the kind of the biggest takeaway I had when we went there was they're really into church planting, and this church is particularly doing it really, really well, such that I thought we should have Pastor David and the other, because they bring up a lot of younger pastors to plant churches, come and do a church planting seminar for the Presbytery of the Alleghenies. I don't even think we have five church plants right now in our whole presbytery. They have five from one church. That, to me, is really, really impressive.
How many members in this church?
So their church, I think, can fluctuate from anywhere from about 150 to about 300. So the way that they do their church planting is it's more of a kind of a parish-based model. So if you imagine driving around here with the PCUSA churches or Lutheran, I always forget, it's not Missouri Synod, what's the other one called? Yeah, which is kind of an irony, but nonetheless, you know how you have like the parish-based model system kind of working? They really built for another time, but the way cars are now, parish-based models just don't work anymore, unfortunately. I'm nostalgic for parish-based models, but since I think just from observation and watching, less people have cars, more people take public transportation, more people walk. Monterey is a very densely populated city. It's about the size of Dallas, but it's just like endless row houses. Does everybody know what a row house? Yeah. The houses that are selling for like $350,000 in Pittsburgh that my immigrant great-grandparents from Poland bought for like nothing. That's what houses look like in Monterey. Everybody looks the same, basically. There's like a 10% of really, really poor, 10% of really, really rich. That other 80%, at least from my perspective, everybody kind of looks the same. So that as we drove around and looked at all the different church plants, seemed to kind of be the model that they were going for, more of a parish-based model. So that's why their church is downtown, and then they get like X amount of people, maybe like four or five families that are from a specific neighborhood that they want to target, and then they commission them to church plant, and then they go find a younger pastor that's probably basically just finishing seminary, and they bring them up to Monterey and they church plant. So it's an interesting model, because Jim was saying that, and it had been, if I'm correct, it had been his experience, people are kind of talking about sustaining their churches or how can we get bigger, and this was a model that was based on hit the threshold, plant, hit, and then the church that was planted, once they hit a threshold, they're supposed to plant too. So it was like replication.
But another church supports them 100% initially.
Yeah.
And then they kind of wean them off as the planted church gets larger, and then eventually they have to plant their own.
Yeah, so, and then they have to plant once they hit like 100 members. So.
Do they get buildings, or do they, like us, kind of find a spot they can?
They're doing a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. They just built one out by the airport. That's the one that we toured. It's really pretty. If you looked at the Facebook photos, it's the more modern-looking one, and they just had their first service, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Okay. I wonder if they,
yeah,
if they made it.
Yep. So they actually had to pay somebody to watch the fixtures because somebody had stole them in the middle of the night. So he's telling the young pastors, like, you might want to sleep here tonight because somebody might steal your fi-. He's like, oh, we didn't. The person that was watching it quit their job. So they have this big campaign called Five and Five. They're trying to plant five churches in 5 years. So it's kind of like a rapid growth. And what's so interesting to me is they're more of a confessionally, it's like we're taking off in the airplane going on a mission trip. But they're more confessionally minded. So these are confessional Presbyterian churches that are growing. They're not trying to do cool and hip stuff. So that was kind of interesting how they can thrive in Mexico. So Five and Five is their big push. So the modern one, when you pull up my presentation later, is the one in the Apodaca neighborhood, and that's out by the airport, which seems to be growing a lot. So I tried to ask Sarah, like, how different does Monterey look from when you grew up, when you were living there 15 years ago from now? And it seems like it's grown a lot. People are dumping in from the countryside to all these different neighborhoods.
But
so
it's the third largest city in Mexico.
Yeah. So Mexico City is number one, and then Guadalajara is number two, and Monterrey is three.
That's a big city.
Yeah, but Monterrey is the most important business city in all of Latin America, more important than Mexico City. They do all kinds of manufacturing there because it's close to the border. You can ship stuff quite easily. So when you drive in the main highway, it's just endless manufacturing. So Lego does all their production there. All their Lego cubes are made in Monterey. Callaway Golf Clubs. I know we have some golfers. Sam, did you golf? No? Okay. Where's Jerry when you need him? Jerry would know about Callaway. So when you drive, Mary Kay, what's that? Makeup is manufactured there too. So I always like to look on certain stuff and see, is this manufactured in Monterey? So Legos is kind of the big one. So there are Five and Five campaign. So I had a map on Monterey. I guess if you have a phone, you could pull up Monterey on Google Maps. But you can kind of see on the map that I have on my presentation, Buen Pastor is right in the smack dab downtown. It's just a few blocks away from the governor's mansion. I think that's what it was called. But surrounding Monterey, you got all these different neighborhoods. So they keep targeting different ones. And I had on here the different ones that they have. So they have, you can see if you pull it up on your phone. It's a nice thing about having a phone, I guess. All the different ones around town they've planted. So Juarez is one that we went to go see. Apodaca is another one. I forget the other gentleman. His church was in a different neighborhood, too. There's another little city, Santiago, that we went to, which was... The Mulks didn't go. We just went there. They have excellent food. But you can kind of see if you threw up a map. I'm assuming they use maps to strategize when they're church planting, but you can see, like, locate all the different churches that they're planting. So it was kind of pretty neat. I don't know of any church planting initiative in the Presbyterian world that's more of now I can't think of the word. Parish-based model, that's what I meant to say. So again, they go 180 to 300 people, then they commission to plant a church. I know a few of us have been to Dallas. Who's been to Dallas before? I know a few of us have. So imagine, that's about the size of Monterey. When you fly into Dallas, I lived there for 3 years. It's like endless sprawl. It's basically like that, but even more squeezed together and congested. Okay, so church planting in northern Mexico. Interestingly enough, all the pastors come from southern part of Mexico. So if you go back and you study the history of church planting or missions in Mexico, the Presbyterians and the Methodists divided Mexico in half. They actually did this with Korea too, except in Korea they divided east and west, if I remember correctly. I think the Presbyterians got west and the Methodists got east. So they planted churches that way. In Mexico, they did it north and south. So they went, Mexico City is kind of like smack dab right in the middle of Mexico. So the Methodists got north and the Presbyterians got south. So that's kind of all null and void. People can plant churches however they so wish now. They don't have territories for church planting anymore like in the early 1900s. But the Presbyterians, I think, have about in Mexico, and there's only one denomination, which is really interesting. There's been no split. As far as I know, talking to the pastors, there's no signs of a split. That to me, reveals something about American culture. We like to fight over every single small thing. And I know Koreans do, too, because how many Presbyterian denominations are in Korea? Yeah. So there's only... I actually thought there was two, because Wikipedia is wrong. It has two Presbyterian churches in Mexico. So I asked Pastor David through Sarah, oh, there's two denominations, right? He's like, no, there's only one. So that was pretty eye-opening to me. So that was pretty encouraging that they only have one. But
is that the one that's connected with the EPC?
Yep.
But that just happened recently, right?
Yeah, like 2 or 3 years ago.
So what was it before then?
PCUSA. So they got rid of their partnership with the PCUSA, and they have one with us and the PCA as well. So I think the long-term goal for our denomination is to recruit pastors to plant Spanish-speaking churches in the United States. Maybe not so much in, I mean, I guess you could plant them in western Pennsylvania, but I'm going to guess more so in the Southwest. We're a little bit behind the Methodists. Back to the Methodists, I guess. My brother-in-law is a Methodist pastor, and he's a church planter, and he had been really successful. He got a church of 200 people, which was the second fastest-growing Hispanic church in the whole United Methodist Church. But the problem is people move so fast. They're like drifters. Until Hispanic men get married and settled down, they just... Somebody would say, come into the church and literally say, we have a job in Omaha, Nebraska. Do you want to go with me? And they just get up that next day and then go move to Omaha, Nebraska. So he would just constantly churn through people in his church. So he hit basically a ceiling and couldn't get an established church. So that was one of the unique problems. But the Methodist Church has done a really good job. I only know of like two Spanish-speaking churches in the EPC thus far. So hopefully we kick it into high drive there. But that's from our perspective. From their perspective, I think they would like mission trips, financial support. The early church, Rome, became the center of everything because they had all the money, so they would support all these other churches. If you look at financially who has the most money in the world in terms of Christians, it's the United States. So financially, so to speak. But giving financially, our dollars can go way further on the mission field than vice versa, so to speak. So, yes, Sam?
What is the Catholic Church doing while this is all going on?
So that's interesting. I think one of the ways that they grow is the Catholic Church in Mexico is still pretty old, what I would call pre-Vatican II Catholic, or at least it looks that way from my perspective. So one of the ways that they can recruit people or evangelize them is they want to know what, everybody wants to know what the Bible says. So Presbyterians have always taught the Bible really well. So they'll come in, so they have a lot of Catholic converts in the Presbyterian Church in Mexico. I think they kind of poach them, so to speak. That was Sarah's question, because her parents come from a more Pentecostal background, and for them to come to any Presbyterian service seems, quote, Catholic to them, which if you've been to a Catholic service, we're not very Catholic, but that's a whole different story. But I think Catholics would feel more comfortable in a Presbyterian service than kind of a praise and worship type of environment. So, yep, that's a good question, because that was one of the questions that we had. If you're having this rapid growth, where on earth are you pulling all these people from? So they divided north and south. So Presbyterians planted churches in the south. Right now, if I remember correctly, they have 4,800 churches south of Mexico City. They only have roughly about 200 north of Mexico City. So there's a big push over the next few decades to push to plant churches in northern Mexico. And one of the unique problems that they have is the 200 versus 4,800, there's actually more Presbyterians in Mexico across the board than in the United States, which was another eye-opener to me. I would have never, ever thought that there was more Presbyterians in Mexico than the United States. But they have to get pastors from the south to plant churches in the north, and you kind of have cultural issues like in the United States, basically. So they want more homegrown pastors going forward because they seem to be more successful. all the pastors that we met seemed to come from a state called Chiapas, which is a kind of a, they're famous for their food, and it's a more indigenous type of culture. Going from that to highly urbanized Monterey has been kind of tough for the pastors. So that was one of the things that he told us about, which was really interesting. So I have a, well, you can see it on the thing. It's not a good picture anyways, but Jeff Jeremiah, when they ratified the deal or the partnership, he was with the moderator of the INPM, Presbyterian Church. So they have a special push in northern Mexico. So when we went, we did theological education. We thought through, well, and at least I did, in terms of gift giving, like my presentation in November, what are the gifts that we could give to them? What could they give to us in the future? And we thought we erred pretty strong on theological education. So Jim and I and Sarah taught on theology. So Jim, do you want to share a little bit about what you taught on? I'm putting on the spot, but well, you're a pastor. You have plenty of experience.
I get here next Sunday, but I knew that was going to be more theological, coming fresh out of seminary. So I decided to go a little more practical, I guess. So I went through the pastoral epistles and picked out a couple of themes regarding your conscience. Down here and guarding your words, not getting caught up in controversies and debates and that sort of thing. And just looked at all the verses. In the three pastoral epistles, those topics are covered numerous times, as well as a number of other topics that Paul just keeps hitting over and over and over. And I thought, well, if it was important to them, it's probably important to me. And so I just sort of walked through some of those verses and talked about them.
Yeah, and Jim was a real trooper because he got the later times than me, so.
Yeah, like 8 o'clock at night.
That's what time people get off work and can make it, so. I got the early shift, he got the late one. That's a pretty tough, so that's about what time I'm going to sleep. I taught on Trinitarian worship and sacraments, and then on Sunday, Pastor David asked if I could do Sunday school, so I did missional friendship, so everything we heard about. Basically recycling topics. That's how pastors cheat, so to speak. But we talked about missional friendship, and it seemed to be well-received. But again, they're doing so well with evangelism there. I felt kind of out of place kind of teaching them. I felt like they had more to teach us in that regard. So they enjoyed it. Something interesting is they catechize. So to be a member of the church, you have to join a group for a year. It's a year-long process, and they use a word that Catholics tend to use called catechumens, which is a more ancient word. I know they're teaching them well because when I taught on Trinitarian worship, I was using a lot of technical Reformed jargon, and the pastors would answer my question before I said it. So the covenant of redemption, I'd mentioned that in a sermon a couple weeks ago. Pedro is his name. It's like, oh, yeah, I know everything about that. And I thought to myself, well, they're doing catechism quite well. So they didn't throw catechism out like the PCUSA did in the 1960s. They stuck with it, and it's bore a lot of fruit. So that was another interesting cultural perspective. Because me personally, when I go there, I'm always looking at what are they culturally doing that's different than us, and where are we doing things better, or where are they doing things better, then you can kind of discern the differences between the culture. I personally find that stuff quite interesting. So, Sarah spoke about prayer. She had the largest group. She probably had about 60 women come to the women's Bible study, so that was really cool. So she spoke. She's told me that she feels more comfortable teaching in Spanish than in English. So, so she taught. That was really cool. So she taught about wrestling with God through the Psalms and Hannah's prayer, and a few of the other famous prayers in Scripture. One of the things that I enjoy, this is coming from my perspective, is each day we had lunch with a different person that seems to be a key player in the church, so an elder or a deacon.
Or a businessman.
Yeah, a businessman. So the first lunch that we had is we had lunch with a guy by the name of Julio Alfredo Puente, and we ate at this really excellent restaurant called Los Frijoles. I forget what I had there, but it was good nonetheless. Julio came into the Reformed tradition about 2 years ago, and he's extremely evangelistic about the Reformed tradition. So it was really interesting to talk to him through Sarah for about an hour or two. Another thing in Mexico, you don't have dinner or lunch with people for like 30 minutes. You're usually there for two and a half hours. And the nice thing about that is the waiters and waitresses don't nag you to leave because they want to turn tables. They just kind of like let you go. Although that can present a problem because then you have to flag somebody down to get your bill. So Julio is really into the Reformed tradition. And what he does, because there's not a lot of books in Spanish in the Reformed tradition, he buys them through Amazon and then he on the digital copies, and he sits at his desk during lunch and throws them into Google Translate and then reads them that way. So I've been actually sending him messages on Facebook. When I see a book that I thought was really good released in Spanish, I send it to them and then he buys it. But he's doing this stuff on Google Translate, which is kind of funny, which would present problems with trans, but nonetheless, he's so enthusiastic about the Reformed tradition that he's doing this. So it's quite encouraging to sit across from somebody like this. I think he said he went like Pentecostal, Reformed Baptist, and then Presbyterian. It might have was raised Catholic. So I think Pastor David is going to nominate him for elder or deacon in the near future. So that was a cool lunch with him. So it demonstrated, at least to me, that people should invest, or Christian publishers should invest in translation projects from English into Spanish. We're pretty blessed to be either English speakers. We don't know German, but in theology, German and English have dominated the space with the great thinkers in the past 200 years. So we have the luxury of being able to read in English the great works, but our brothers and sisters in Christ who read in Spanish don't have that luxury. So it was really neat to see somebody like Julio kind of thirsting for this, such that he uses Google Translate to read these works. So on my slide, I had a big smiley face, but I said perhaps this could be a job for Sarah in the future, or she could start her own Christian publishing company and just translate everything. So what that actually taught me one important thing that I think the EPC could learn from the INPM. That's what the acronym for Presbyterian Church in Mexico is. They're not embarrassed to have transfer growth. In other words, when they have people that convert to the Reformed tradition, they don't see that as a bad thing. And I think the Lord's really been teaching me that that's okay. We should rejoice when people come into our tradition or are very enthusiastic about it. I almost get the impression, I love the EPC, but sometimes in the national level, we're embarrassed by people that convert to our tradition, where I think that the Presbyterian Church in Mexico sees that as a net gain. So that's what they were teaching me there. So I always, when I'm praying as the pastor, I pray for new converts to the faith, which we had one this year and we should rejoice, converts to our tradition, and sheep that are kind of out there not doing anything. So those are kind of the way I categorize people instead of lumping them into one big category. So, in fact, I pray this for Zoe because I pray that she confirms her baptism when she's older. So I think about her a little bit different. So, yeah. So that was really neat. The second lunch that we had was with a guy by the name of Ricardo. Not speaking Spanish got me out of a kind of a bind here because Ricardo drives a Tesla. He owns a big company in Monterey. He's a really wonderful guy. But I was sitting in front with Pastor David, and I was like, who drives a Tesla in Mexico? And sure enough, it was the guy that was taking us out to lunch. So I usually really try to watch what I say, and I blurted this out. I'm like, thank God I didn't say that in Spanish, or I would have come across as really rude to Pastor David. But I also mentioned to him that I have a cousin who's an engineer for Tesla. So he said, maybe next time they can give me a discount. But it got me out of trouble that I couldn't speak enough Spanish that time. He runs a HR company. I think he has offices in London and in Costa Rica, if I'm remembering correctly. And he talked about some of the needs of the Presbytery of Monterey in the future. He asked, and he was saying that him and Pastor David, that they liked the theological education that we did, but they would need more practical training. And I still kind of need to figure out what they mean by that, if that means counseling. Pastors are really overworked there. So I thought maybe a workshop on, like, because he did HR, maybe guarding your time or not letting your work and family life kind of leech together. I know the EPC does a really good job there where they ask us if we took our vacation every year. And if we didn't, we have to tell them why. So, which is pretty cool. I like that. That's good that they watch after their pastors that way. And they mentioned that maybe we could host some pastors in the future to do like a 2 or 3 week intensive type of discipleship here. I guess we could do that in ear.
Internship.
Yeah, like an internship. So we were chatting about that. So maybe that's something we could explore in the future. But the pastors have to speak English, obviously. I'm not going to take Sarah around with me for 2 weeks everywhere, and the three of us are going to go hang out and translate. So, although Pastor David's, all of his kids spoke really good English. So we were joking about who we can hook them up with and young people, because his daughters seem like really nice girls in particular. So May and June, they said in the future would be a better time to do a mission trip. So I'm thinking maybe something possibly in 2021, not this coming. May and June would be too quick of a turnaround, but we could do that in the future. We actually ate at this restaurant. Well, you can see the picture again. It was my favorite restaurant. They had really good coffee there. It's from Mexico City. And Jay ordered a, since she's not here, but she ordered a big pineapple drink, and they brought her a whole pitcher. That was kind of funny. But the food was they had really, really good coffee. And Sarah took a video where they, you have coffee here, but the guy pours the steamy milk from like all the way up here. I don't know. It was a really yummy restaurant. So I enjoyed my time there. Another person that we spent time with that made a kind of an impression on me was a man by the name of Pedro. His son's actually married to Pastor David's daughter. I didn't know that till later. It's amazing what Facebook can teach you. So Pedro's church serves what is called the Rincon neighborhood. And this is a church that's set up to minister to migrant workers. So there's migrant workers that come into Monterey for a couple months at a time, and then they go back. In particular, they go to, or they're from San Luis Potosí. I can never spell that one correctly. So they go back and forth, and so it's been kind of hard for him to establish a church. They went from church plant to establish church, and then because they're migrant workers, they've got kind of kicked around a lot. So they're trying to figure out how to do things into the future.
But their attendance is way up some months, and then
yeah,
it drops down to almost none, and then bounces back up.
Yeah, so his church was interesting because we're like, why is everything, because this was in mid-November, why is everything dressed up for Christmas? And he's like, well, we're having Christmas like next week because everybody's going home for December. So, and then I know maybe it was a little bit discouraging for Pedro, but they're right next door to a Seventh-day Adventist church, which is huge, and it's got this huge, beautiful school, and then the Presbyterian mission is like right next door, so. And they could use some money to upgrade their facilities. The next person that whose church we went to, his name was Abner. So he's a younger pastor in his early 30s. He's in the Juarez neighborhood. One of the interesting things that I wrote down about visiting him was they use traditional forms of Reformed worship. So call to worship, confession, assurance, sermon, obviously, and sacraments. Another interesting thing is that a lot of the younger pastors are pushing for weekly communion, which I thought, oh, this is kind of an American thing, but this is more of an international type of thing. So a lot of the young pastors that are coming into the pastorate are changing their churches to do weekly communion. But this particular church, they did contemporary music and hymns. Not praise and worship type of stuff, but they were doing more of a blended type of service. His church, if you think we have it bad with kids, They have a their space for watching kids is 5 blocks away from where they worship. And you have to keep in mind, Mexico or Monterey gets to be about 115 degrees in the summer. So you could imagine going out into the heat at 11 o'clock and going to have to gather the kids 5 blocks away. So I kind of contextualize sometimes the what we have. I mean, we don't have the nicest room, but it's better than walking 5 blocks to go gather the kids.
Well, and their third or fourth different place?
I think it was like fifth or sixth.
They had to meet. They had to keep moving because they lost leases or different things have changed. And there's a storefront now, so that's made it difficult to maintain continuity when they keep having to change locations.
Yep, that's correct. And if I remember, if I understood Pastor DeVee correctly, they built this other church in Apodaca, but now, then after they finished that, which they did, they're going to raise money to build a church there so they can stop bouncing around from different space to different space. So it was interesting meeting with him because we're like, well, we're in the same spot. We've jumped around. We're in a hotel right now. We've been in a traditional church, but they've been bouncing around back and forth as well. And I think he said that that's been a little bit tough on them to get an established space dedicated to ministry. Because Mexicans are very traditional. I think, very creative with space, but at the same time, I think it would be a challenge to not have an established space. I think the same could be said for us, too, in Erie. So again, they'll have their building built next. The last one, the church that we visited, was a gentleman by the name of Luis Miguel. His is the newer church, and it actually is completed. On my slides, I said January of 2020, but it is completed. So they had their first worship service there. And he actually was really, really excited and grinning from ear to ear about the new space that they dedicated for the church. And he said, well, next time you shouldn't have your theological education conference at El Buen Pastor. Why don't you have it at the new church? So he was really excited. So that was pretty cool. And again, El Buen Pastor totally funded this whole building. So that was pretty neat. They probably have some stuff that they could fix around their church, but at the same time, they're more focused on kingdom realities and building this other church. So
they didn't find it out of their budget.
Oh yeah, that's right.
There's all special gifts.
Yeah. So yeah, that's probably the other thing that was interesting. Most of the vocations that the Presbyterians had were similar to what our vocations, an upper middle class type of background. So we would get back from lunch and these elders would take us to really nice restaurants in town. And Sarah's mom would be like, why on earth did they take you there? And then I made the joke, it pays to be Presbyterian sometimes.
But with El Buen Pastor, isn't there like 45% of their budget goes to the planted churches?
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
I mean, like half their budget is going to these mission churches.
Yeah, it sounds similar to the church that the Wilsons. You guys, 50% of your budget went to missions? Was that 50%, Dean, that you guys invest in your church in Connecticut at one time?
Yes, 50% admissions.
Okay. Yeah, so it's kind of a similar outlook. That would be nice to maybe do in the future here.
I asked Pastor David, I said, is that an issue with some of the congregation members that they're giving money, but only half is staying here and half is going to these other churches? He said, yeah, with some people, it's an issue, but it's just, who they are as a congregation, people have to realize that. Because there's some things that could be fixed up around their church.
Yep.
It's like, why we send all this money to these other churches? We have some things that need fixed here, but it's just, that's their priority.
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a really great book called Calvin and His Company of Pastors, and it's a social history. So you can see how they did implanted churches and supported everything. And actually, what they're doing in El Buen Pastor is very similar to what Calvin did in Geneva, where you kind of had the main hub church, and then it supported all the other churches on the outside in Geneva. So it's kind of interesting to see it, that you have kind of roots in how to do church planting this way. That's the book that somebody had to go before Calvin and his company of pastors because they refused to take their bloodhound and musket out of the worship space So the pastor got really mad at him, and they had to go to session for church discipline. I've always found that quite funny. Now we need guns to protect people in church service. Calvin was trying to get them out, so it's kind of funny. So I have a slide, partnering with Blaine Pastor in the future. So they were actually thrilled to have us. Monterey's gotten a lot safer over the past couple years. It was really dangerous a couple years ago, but it's fine now. But since it still has that rep... Yes, Tim?
I'm thinking about the drug cartels. Yep.
Yep. No, I don't think it really affects everyday life too much for the average Mexican. I've asked Sarah about this. It's kind of like people that get killed they're already involved in that type of life. That's what a few years ago the kidnappings made a lot of shocking to people. There's a specific cartel called the Zetas. They've kind of gone away now, but they were kidnapping people. That's different than if you're familiar with El Chapo. His thing, he kind of had like a truce with the government. You don't bother me and I won't bother you and I won't kidnap people and things. So they kind of like kill people that are involved in the drug trafficking trade. Although, it's weird. I really wanted to go to this restaurant in the really fancy part of town. They have black tacos al pastor, which are my favorite ones. It's weird. The wealthy place is not safe to go to in Monterey. You're better off hanging out in the barrio, which is the hood, where my in-laws live. Nobody will bother you there. But if you go to the nice part of town, it's a big risk, actually, which I thought was a little bit of a paradox. It's kind of the opposite in the United States. So but that's a good question.
Well, there are some parts of Mexico where the drug cartel, drugs are more of an issue.
Yeah, so Monterey's kind of did away with it. I've been to Juarez before. Juarez is really unsafe.
Yeah.
You're not even really, we had to go, this makes no sense. The United States government, the major visa processing area is in Juarez, so we had to go there to get Sarah's visa to come back home. We weren't allowed to go outside, or you're not supposed to go out of the hotel at all, and especially not at night. Which is really sad because El Paso is a really safe city, or at least they advertise it that way. And it's like one city when you fly over it, but the border's in between. So it's sad that one area is so bad and then El Paso is quite safe. Yeah, so I've known our home church, they did a mission trip in Juarez, but that was several decades ago when I think it was safer. I wouldn't want to take anybody there now. If you did, you'd have to be really, really careful. So partnering with them in the future, Pastor David would like to continue to do the stuff that we did last time. But there's plenty of one thing, because this was kind of a scouting trip, is we were just looking around, like, what our needs. We could do more traditional type of mission work in the future. So one that Sarah did when she was, or Americans did when she was a little girl, she grew up in the Nazarene tradition, and American missionaries would come and they would do... Vacation Bible School. So she has vivid memories as a small kid of Americans coming to town, and they did all the grunt work for Vacation Bible School for the pastor and his wife. So that was a huge blessing. So we could do something like that, specifically with Pedro's church. I know they have a lot of kids. They have like 40 adults that come to service and like 40 children. It's something crazy because their families are really, really big. You can kind of see it, but I'm going to try to get some churches together in the EPC that might be interested in giving some money, or I could pass it around later or show you, but the children's space at this place was just abysmal. It was just sad. I'm not the person to cry, but it made you want to cry just looking at it. But then again, he's acting like it's not a big deal. And our thought went to you, well, there's no AC. I was like, well, could we buy you some AC heaters? He's like, no, we really need like a divider so we could split off the kids. Heat was not something that really bothers them. So it kind of put it into context. But their church needs a lot of work. So you would not pass children's inspections there for where they put kids. We could also, traditional Vacation Bible School, or we could do traditional work like paint or work at existing buildings. I have a picture also on the presentation. We ate at a, supposedly it's one of the nicer restaurants in town, so we ate this cabrito, it's called. It's baby goat. It was really interesting. It's a real traditional method they do to cook it. It was pretty good. I think Jim liked it a lot.
Yeah, for the next few days.
It just didn't digest. And we ate. And we ate there the day before they took their, yeah. Okay, so what biggest takeaways from my perspective? El Buen Pastor and the Mexican Presbyterian Church are holding on to their covenant children. This actually doesn't seem to be the case across the board in the EPC. At the very least, we're probably doing like 50%. So one of the things I found quite, and this could be social factors, such as children live with their parents until they get married. That's not how we do it in the States. So all the kids that were home for like Christmas, for example, once you hit 18, if you're going to go to college, you're gone, basically. And maybe you might move back in your 30s. That seems to be the case in Erie and Pittsburgh, at least. But you stay with your folks until you marry. So that's a little bit different, which is a little bit kind of weird to an American, where we prioritize freedom, where freedom isn't as big of a deal to Mexicans. So, but they hold on to their covenant children. So it was common in El Buen Pastor to have four generations of families in their congregation. So it was really neat to see on Sundays, the Sundays we've been there, where you have maybe great-grandpap sitting with his great-grandson and likewise. So they're doing a really good job. And it could be just a trademark of their catechism, where they push it. They still do it with kids. So that was really interesting to me. So I think the EPC, and I'm talking about the broad denomination, could learn from them. Another thing is they're not ashamed of their confessional heritage. So that was a big takeaway. And the other interesting thing is they have an overabundance of younger ministers, which is one of the challenges for the EPC going forward. So they just have every single pastor that we've met other than Pastor David was my age or younger, I think. So that was really encouraging that they have, because they only ordained men, but all these young men are heeding the call to pastoral ministry. So that was really encouraging.
What kind of training do they have to have? Do they have a similar seminary?
Yep, same as us. So, yep. And I think the really smart students tend to go to Reformed Theological Seminary or Westminster Theological Seminary, and then go back and teach as professors. So,
there's a couple seminaries there.
Yeah, they have one in Mexico City. They have one in Chiapas. And then they have one in Mérida. Those are all south of Mexico City. They do not have a seminary in the northern part. So,
but then Pastor David meets regularly with these church planting pastors. So he's continuing to disciple them and train them.
Yeah, so you could almost make the argument he's kind of like the bishop of Monterey. I mean, he's investing a lot. He's not the bishop, but he kind of is. So.
Well, El Buen Pastor planted 80% of Presbyterian churches in Monterey.
Yeah, right? Yep, most of them come from El Buen Pastor. So, yeah. Sorry, back to Calvin again, since I know it's interesting how there's some similarities. But Calvin used to meet with his pastors in the whole Geneva parish model once a week. So, and they would actually preach on the same topic. So all his commentaries are really not just him, but they're all these pastors that worked together and labored together and all had insights. So, but Pastor David does a similar thing with them. So that was pretty cool. So we could offer a mission trip in 2021 in May or June. And I have to talk with them about this, but maybe we could, perhaps in the off year when we don't send a team, we could have a team come to us. I've talked about this in the past. Our home church does that with their partnership in Africa. So they'll go over to Africa once every other year, and then they'll send a team, mostly just their pastors, every other year to come to their church. So we're a little bit of an older congregation now, so maybe they could send us a bunch of young people if we get our own building and they could paint for us. So that would be really nice. So it'd be kind of funny how if anybody's ever been on a mission trip, maybe you did grunt work, or we might get blessed by another church where they could come and do the grunt work for us. But one of the things that I liked, in my last picture, it's Jim, Pastor David, and myself at the Lord's table. We all officiated communion together at the end. But one of the great things about mission trips is they bear witness to the world to come, that all nations worship together at the Lord's table. So one of my favorite things, because I can't understand enough Spanish to follow the sermon. I can kind of understand a little bit or what's going on with it, because I use the same modes of worship that we do. But one of the things that I really understand is when we come to the Lord's table together. So that was really cool. And on Sunday, when we finished, Pastor David did a really Mexican thing and called me forward in front of the whole church, like 200 people, and I had to talk for like 2 seconds, and I got to say thank you and things like that. So it was really, really cool. So that is my Sunday school lesson. Anybody have any questions about our trip for the last 10 minutes? Marty?
Do they tend to discourage women from becoming pastors, or is it just something within the EPC church in Mexico?
Yes, so they would hold to that the pastoral epistles in Timothy and Titus restrict women from being pastors.
I didn't deal with those passages.
Yeah. Yeah, we made sure to tell Jim before we left. But women are very much involved in ministry. So sometimes, so that position is called complementarian. Sometimes people go so extreme that they won't allow women to play music at all in service. But that is not what they did at Buen Pastor. Women are involved heavily and do a lot of work. So they don't have female deacons, but observing, they do have female deacons. It's kind of like one of those things. The PCA's like that a lot, too. So, yeah.
I was surprised when we shared communion. We were standing around a table, just as the pastors and a few women. And the one woman took the elements and actually passed them around.
He didn't stop her. So.
Yeah, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah.
Normally women aren't allowed to even touch them, you know, because they get cooties or something.
Yeah, it's always important to put it in perspective. Female pastors is a minority position in the global church. Maybe in the American church, it's about, I don't know, 50-50. But if you put it in perspective in the global church, and you just think about Roman Catholicism, if you count Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy, they don't ordain women to ministry. So, and when you put it in a global, when you make global partnerships, often you will not have female pastors. So even though I would say that scripture teaches that we can't have female pastors, but that's a whole different story.
Well, when I was preparing, I had to send all my stuff to Sarah ahead of time. She wanted to see what I was going to be saying, so she could be prepared for translation and know what was coming. And in my one talk, I talked about not getting involved in getting caught up in meaningless debates and ongoing things that go nowhere. For example, women in ministry. Examples. And she said, they see that a little bit differently. I said, oh, good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, like Sarah, when we were talking to him, said or told the women that she is ordained as a deacon. She's been ordained at our home church as a deacon. And they weren't rude about it or anything. That wasn't, they didn't shun us or anything. Sometimes you get that in the American context and it's weird on both sides. So that's the genius of the EPC. Both positions can kind of cohabitate together, which I like.
Non-essential.
Yep. And the EPC does a really good job at, that's part of our culture, which I really, really enjoy. So.
But it was important to understand that for them, it was not a non-essential.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And some churches and, sorry, I'm going off a tangent. Any other questions?
So, back to the church plans. The congregation that you went to see, the main one, they've planted all these churches. Do they do that by hiring a pastor and putting that pastor in place? And then, do people from the congregation go and seed the new congregation? How does that...
Does
the church actually do to plant these churches?
They hire somebody from seminary, fresh out of seminary, typically. So they're paying for him to pastor. And, they go in and check. Pastor David, when they're a mission... He kept saying missions, and when I... That was the other interesting mission for them is church planting. So we thought they have all these other missions. We thought they were like charities. So we would show up and it would be an orphanage for example, when we showed up, it was all about church planting, which was different than what we had expected.
You said the people that lived in a certain place were like the seed.
Yeah, so like
5 to 10 families, I think.
Yeah, so think in terms of Erie, like since we all have a history with Covenant, Covenant's kind of the main hub. And then if you had a bunch of people driving front, there was no Presbyterian church in Girard, for example. You had 5 families driving in from Girard. The pastor would say, well, why are you driving in from Girard? We're going to plant a church there. And that's kind of how they do things. So, it's just so interesting that they weren't about keeping the building going. They could have fixed some stuff, but they're all about kingdom growth. So they can reach people in those particular neighborhoods. In fact, Sarah's one friend, Maradi, we went to go see her. She's been a friend of ours for a long time, was kind of complaining about her Methodist church. So I told Sarah to tell her, you know that there's a new church building in your neighborhood that you can go to, and we met the pastor, and he's a really great guy. Because the pastor at the Methodist church told her not to share the gospel with Mormons. And Sarah's like, no, share the gospel with Mormons. Like, shun them, basically. It's like, yeah, don't do that.
The home church, the mother church, pays a salary for their hope. Their goal is, I think, for the planted church to become independent within 5 years.
Or yeah.
Well, but not all the churches. They're not paying full salary for all 5. Some of them, they're just paying part of the salary. They sort of wean them so they can be independent.
Yeah.
But initially, yeah, they're fully supporting.
Yeah, so it was a pretty neat experience. I thought we were just going to see like charities, basic 5 different charities, and it turned out to be 5 church plants, and we were kind of shocked about that. So, yes.
It's just challenging.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
Because, our mindset is, let's see how big we can get our church. We've got the biggest church, but their mindset is, hey, we're big enough, let's
which is another interesting thing, because we all have been leaders that I'm looking at. Presbyterianism can only really work after you get about 500 members, it's really hard to run a Presbyterian church, in my opinion. Like, once you get to 500, it probably has to cease becoming a Presbyterian church. Or maybe even you could argue lower, because you need a lot of lay involvement. So their church planting method made a lot of sense within the polity of how Presbyterians do run the church, basically. And probably how the early church did it as well. I don't think Paul was saying, hey, let's build a giant building. And he was planting different communities in different neighborhoods, basically. So we tend to think that the early church was quite big. It was pretty small, actually. So, okay, well, that concludes my talk. If you want to see the slides, they'll be thrown up online, so you can just look at the pictures, or you could go back through the Facebook page and look at them as well. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me. Thank you.